Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This week, we're going to drill down a little further on making arrangements for your lives in the event that you might become incompetent. There might be a period of time, none of us knows, when before we die, we may not be able to manage our money. We may not be able to make important decisions for ourselves. So we know this is a concern that, quite frankly, every survey has shown dominates the thoughts of people as they age. And we want to be clear with this show, especially considering the involvement of Cordell Planning Partners, we want to be sure that we don't fail to talk about your options and to make this perfectly clear what are some wonderful and simple and, in most cases, inexpensive tools to assure that things don't go south. And what better way to make that point than with some cautionary tales, cautionary tales involving names that you might have heard of. And even if you haven't heard of the names, these are people who had every incentive to try to do things right, and things went wrong. And remember, we're not talking about probate here, just to make this clear.
Nope.
This show today is not about probate, not about what's going to happen after you're gone. These are situations where people's finances, their care suddenly went sideways. There were abuses that occurred. But all these things happened before they died because they didn't have in place something that would give them protection for the balance of their lives. And again, we talk about estate planning a lot. This show is not so much about quote-unquote estate planning, meaning figuring out who gets your stuff when you pass away. Important as that is, I think the surveys are clear that, and Susan, we've looked at how many surveys?
Oh, we've looked at dozens and dozens of surveys. And the thing is, we don't want this to be scary. Most of us don't want to give up control. And that's a very scary emotional thing. But when we look at some of the examples of
Brooke Astor,
I was going to say some of these names that you'll recognize, she had financial abuse at the hands of her son while she suffered from Alzheimer's. I mean, who wants that? And then we've heard stories, we've talked on this show before about Casey Kasem and Buzz Aldrin. You know, these are famous people who you think, oh, surely they know better. Surely they're going to have good advisors. Surely they're going to make all of the right decisions. And some of them, in their best efforts, still manage to make an unwise decision. And that's what we want to help you avoid.
And what's interesting about these cases is these cases do not involve, I don't think any of them involve cases where there's nothing in place.
Right.
Meaning there is no power of attorney, there is no trust. In other words, these people just entirely took the risk, rolled the dice, and said, I'm going to be competent and responsible for managing my affairs for the balance of my life. These are cases where these people probably all went to lawyers. They had what they thought was a reliable or a proper, durable power of attorney in place, or a trust. We've talked about both in the past. We'll touch on those again today. But it still wasn't enough. And the bottom line is that it's not enough to simply have this document that says power of attorney in place, durable power of attorney, and to sleep well, confident that your life is now handled. There are a few key ingredients that need to be in that document that we think that for these examples we're about to give you and talk about, we think these could have been easily corrected by just making five, maybe seven or so changes to those documents that would have provided all the protection these people needed.
And to think deeply and critically about your decisions. I mean, just because someone is the oldest, and I'm speaking as the oldest child, doesn't mean that they are necessarily the best fit to manage your assets or to manage your life or to manage your healthcare decisions. And sometimes, which is what happened in a lot of these celebrity cases, they put someone in charge and they did their due diligence, but they made an unwise choice.
Yeah, and many think that this decision is a sort of a birthright. So it's less about deciding, is this the right person, than it is about this person occupies a certain position. Mm-hmm. For example, my firstborn male child. There's still that thinking around uh-huh. these days. Or my oldest child. But the bottom line is it's about which child or which person, maybe it's not a child, is the best candidate to play this role.
Well, and the important thing to think about that is I think a lot of parents just don't want to do that because, oh, I don't want to appoint someone who's not a child or not a family member because that's going to create family disharmony. But the question I think we all need to ask ourselves is if by appointing that person who doesn't maybe have the skills or the ability to do it, aren't we creating family disharmony in the future?
Yeah, there can be worse things than mm-hmm. that your son, your oldest son is disappointed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can get worse than that.
Well, and if you do a quick internet search, you will certainly find case after case and example after example where someone thought they were doing the right thing. And it's really awful. But as soon as the person dies, boy, it brings out the worst in people sometimes.
So what we're doing really today is drilling down. We've beat the drum in the past about needing to have certain things in place to assure that the balance of your life goes according to your plan, that your retirement savings, that your health care, et cetera, are properly managed. This is drilling down a little further. This is saying, well, it's great to have that piece of paper that is called a durable power of attorney or a trust. It's great to have those things, but let us go a little further in mm-hmm. what we think you need to have. These are the things that you need to include or think about including, at least, in your trust. Some people will think about them and decide, no, that's not for my situation. Fair enough. But I think that you should be reluctant to reach that conclusion without knowing the ramifications.
Okay, so let's say we've done the first thing. We have a power of attorney or a power of attorney for health care, a trust. We've done something. And probably the first decision that we're going to have to make is who are we going to have to administer that or to be the agent for us? So what types of things would you recommend that we look at in choosing that person? Now, we've already talked about it doesn't necessarily have to be a family member. It doesn't necessarily have to be child number one or child number two. And obviously, the most obvious to me anyway, is that you want to have someone that you trust. But are there some other things that we should look at? And how do we maybe determine someone that we trust?
Okay, so let's, and I encourage our listeners to take notes and to even pull out, go and find the drawer that you have your durable power of attorney in and pull it out and perhaps look at it as we're talking here. But you do. I think you raised, Susan, the first question that needs to be asked, and that if you are going to give someone authority and power over your stuff and your life, your person and your things, then who is the person that should occupy that role? And many people are fortunate enough to where a child is that person. Mm-hmm. Many of us can say, yeah, I have one or more children that I completely trust. I think the primary criteria are twofold. I think on the one hand, there needs to be somebody who has integrity. I think that's first and foremost. I think if somebody has integrity, even if they're not the most knowledgeable or the smartest, they can still know to perhaps seek the opinion of others. So integrity is huge. Mm-hmm. But assuming they have integrity, the second thing that I think is important, critical, is that they have sound judgment. Again, not knowledge, not a business degree. Those are all things that's nice. A law degree, that'd be nice too. But but the thing that really has to be there is the person has to have good judgment. In their role, there are lots of experts around them, lots of places to which they can turn for direction and information. So let's assume that they're going to have to do that. And now you're looking for that person, though, that has that wisdom and that reliability.
The ability to know that they don't know something and to find out who to ask.
Yeah, that's huge. And now, let me hurry and throw out an idea here to you that we see was a mistake in some of the, as we look at some of the high profile mishaps involving this sort of planning, is there seemed to be the presumption in almost every one of these cases that we've looked at, there was one person in charge. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a panel. It wasn't even two. It was an individual. So I want to suggest to you that number one, take the care we just mentioned regarding the appointment of an individual if an individual is available. But equally effective for many people is to identify two people or three. And some would say, well, it should be an odd number in case there's a disagreement. Okay, I get that. As long as you have, though, a tiebreaker, somebody who you identify to break any point of disagreement between the two, I think often that's good enough. And if you only have two that you really trust, and in this case you're confident that they're not likely to have those conflicts regularly, if there's a history of a relationship between those kids, mm-hmm. then I don't think you should automatically say, I can't choose two because it's an even number and they could butt heads.
All right, I have a couple of questions with that then. So let's say that you have two children and you appoint them both equally. What happens when one lives close by and one lives in California?
That's really not a problem at all, actually.
Okay.
And the reason it's not is that if there's a good relationship, then the California one can largely defer to the local kid. And yes, there should be communication regularly. There should be participation in decisions. There will be things that will have to be signed off on. And now we find that's less of an issue than it was at one time. There's software to make that easier. But there are ways in which you could simply say that the person in the other city had veto power. Again, it's no worse than simply coming to a point where you disagree. But there are a number of ways you can write into the power of attorney a scenario in which you do have one person locally who's doing most things, and maybe and I think that your question implies that, yeah, it is a little inconvenient.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that. It is a little inconvenient. But it's not a showstopper anymore. It does mean the person on the ground locally is doing all the running around, and what they're getting from the person in California is signatures and authorizations, which can be pretty readily provided.
Now, would it be a good idea, though, in that situation to have maybe two people in one area go ahead and appoint that third person? Because here's the scenario I'm thinking of is the person that lives in the same city as, let's say, mom is doing most of the work, is maybe paying the bills.
They are.
Is doing running for errands. And so sometimes I've heard of situations, well, we paid for that out of mom's account. California relative says, wait a minute, you shouldn't pay for that out of mom's account because now that's affecting me and my inheritance. I mean, that just seems like it's a little bit fraught with some difficulty.
Having two agents is. And that's the reason that you need to think carefully about that choice. Now, again, where you have kids that have a long history of a harmonious relationship, you should be able to have reasonable confidence that works. You can still appoint a tiebreaker. It could be a lawyer. It could be somebody who's not quite as intimate, somebody who you don't expect to be involved regularly. It's easy to find somebody who is only giving an opinion when called upon.
Okay, so one person can just be I'm the tiebreaker vote, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
In the event there's a disagreement, then you specify a third party. Another way to do that is to call that person a protector. And that's a role that can exist. It's common to have a what's called a trust protector, meaning a third party kind of hovering out there who is not charged with the duty of running the trust, but is a person that has the power and authority to reach in under circumstances that they think is necessary.
Okay.
And so you could create this protector role to exist with the durable power of attorney.
And that's normally an independent person, or could that be just another really good friend?
Well, let me first say it's not normal,
okay.
meaning that if you were to pull out 50 durable powers of attorney going down the block of your street, you'd find that maybe one or two would have a protector. But my point is under the Uniform Statute, which Missouri adopted, Uniform Durable Power of Attorney Act, that there's nothing to prevent you appointing a protector. But in any case, whether you call it that or not, you can have this third party that can resolve any potential conflicts if you want both your kids to be named. But I would say that if you know that your kids have had conflict, if you know that there's significant risk that they're going to butt heads in the way you just mentioned, it's a good illustration.
Mm-hmm.
You have one who's thinking more about the money that's being depleted.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it's a bad kid.
Right.
But the kid may be, just conscious, very conscious in the way they spend their money. how it's going to impact what's left when mom or dad passes. You'd hope that they wouldn't think that way, but what can you say?
You just never know. Well, and sometimes the kids that are not there don't see the decline in mom.
Yeah, they may not see the need.
Right, they may not see the need. So say, for example, you start spending money every month for an alert system. Well, maybe they don't think they need that. Or, I mean, that's maybe not a good example. But, you know, there's those things where maybe she needed extra help and you've brought in home health care. Mm-hmm. And that can add up very quickly, whereas the one in California is not seeing the decline. And then all of a sudden, the money's going out. And are you sure that you just don't want to take care of her? It just seems very... Oh, it seems like a lot of potential for disagreements.
I don't want to be dismissive about that. I mean, you're right. I've had clients where they've had another kid in another city, and for the most part, it has worked. But I've certainly seen situations where it hasn't worked, but also where they're down the street from each other and it doesn't work.
Well, exactly.
So I think the bigger issue, rather than the geographical, I think the bigger issue is the relational. If they have this relationship, I think that the geographical spread can be bridged, I guess is the way I'd put it. But there are a few more difficulties. All other things being equal, is it simple to have one person locally? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really want to encourage people, though, to consider the possibility of somebody who is appointed outside this individual or these individuals to whom records are submitted. I think this is huge. For example, we talked about Brooke Astor, Casey Kasem also was an example of that. Who else where the money was misused? It was
Buzz
spent.
Aldrin. People didn't like how he was, the decisions that he'd made. They thought he was unable to make decisions.
There's questions about whether or not he was competent.
Right. Another one was Harper Lee and the Marvel Comics mogul Stan Lee. So, owner of Sumner Redstone.
Yeah, we know the Redstone case. Mm-hmm. A lot of familiarity with that as it occupied the front pages of the paper off and on for several years. And that involved a daughter and, of course, an empire and whether or not he was incompetent. And there was a durable power of attorney, incidentally, in effect for a period of time and whether or not that had been triggered. So, whenever you have somebody who you're trusting with such great responsibility, remember, let's go over again that a durable power of attorney empowers someone, generally speaking, to manage everything in your life. This is a wonderful document in many respects, but it is a little scary because it means the person can generally access your retirement accounts, can access your insurance values, whatever may be there in terms of permanent insurance, cash value, et cetera, your investment accounts, your savings, your real estate. Depending on whether you've given the power, they can change or affect your trust and your beneficiary provisions.
There's a lot there.
A lot. The one thing they can't do, and this is by statute, they cannot make or change a will on your behalf. So that's a signature they cannot provide. But short of that, I mean, there is a lot of power in this document. Now, while I've pointed out the unsettling side of it, here's the beauty of it. The beauty of it is that it allows the people who care for you, and it allows you to have peace of mind that if something happens, whether it's precipitous, like you're at dinner and you have a stroke, or whether it's gradual, as some form of dementia, whether it's a car accident, whatever form it takes, rather than go to that traditional channel, the one where someone goes to the courthouse, they file a petition in the probate division for a declaration of incompetency to have someone appointed as a guardian, another person often appointed as a conservator. The guardian manages the person. The conservator manages the money, the regular reporting to the court, the fact that, incidentally, everybody's being paid out of your money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're paying for this party.
Right.
I mean, whenever there's experts testifying, these people who eventually are appointed, they're entitled to be paid. The lawyers coming and going, giving these regular reports to the court. I mean, while it's true that it's good to know that there's a whole lot of oversight, you should also know that there's a whole lot of money that's being spent
cost.
From your from your precious assets that are to pay for your care the balance of your life. So it is a powerful document, but it is a little scary. And I think it's worth thinking about ways that you can fortify this document so that it's likely to be more effective for you and give you more peace of mind. And among those ways that may be done, we've talked about, is the protector. Mm-hmm. So I really want to place that thought in people's minds. They can bring it up to their attorney. They're not likely to hear their attorney mention that to them because it is a little unconventional, but it certainly can be done.
So we've talked a little bit about who we should appoint. What are the types of powers of attorney? When do they take effect? What types of steps need to take place? Do you establish that and say, I'm going to make this happen at this point in time, when I'm officially in the hospital, when I'm in a car accident? How does that work?
Well, let me make one point real quick before I answer that directly. But before I forget about it, and for the listeners, I want them to know about this fortification. And it really ties in with when this takes effect. So in answer to your question, yes, it's true that this document does not have to be in effect immediately. You don't have to simply sign it and hand a copy, as you should, to the person to whom you're giving the power, and it's in effect immediately. But there's a counter argument to that, and that's that, look, if you don't trust the person to do what you want them to do while you're competent, what do you think they're going to do when you're incompetent? Mm-hmm. So I get that. If it's somebody that you truly trust, there are some conveniences associated with having it in effect immediately. You don't have to have a doctor later to certify that an event has occurred. Commonly, the alternative to being in effect immediately is to say that in the event of my becoming incompetent, which will be certified by one or two doctors, then so-and-so will have authority pursuant to this document. That is a hurdle. It's a hurdle that has to get over. It can cause some discomfort on the part of brokers, on the part of banks, other third parties wanting to be sure that this hurdle has been reached. In the event that the event hasn't occurred, then of course they wouldn't be justified in taking that. So they worry about their honoring this document that may in fact not be proper yet, because you may in fact not be incompetent. So whenever you create a hurdle like that, it doesn't mean it's a showstopper, and I don't want to make too much of this argument. It is commonly done. You can have a doctors that you know who they are. You can get to them quickly. But you need to be able to get to them on weekends. You need to be able to get to them at night. I mean, depending on your situation.
Yeah, if you're in a car accident at night, or you have a heart attack in the middle of the night. Yeah.
So, I want to know that my durable power of attorney can take effect immediately. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to think that my doctor can be on vacation for 2 weeks and another doctor is not comfortable doing it because they don't want to be potentially liable for somebody they don't know. So it can slow things down. I'll say it that way. But if you don't have anyone that you feel so strongly confident about, that you're prepared to give them authority immediately, then yes, that's your alternative. Is it's triggered? It's called a springing power of attorney. It's triggered by some event which would require establishing that you're incompetent.
Well, and that seems to be a little bit challenging for mental decline, which would be a lot more difficult to be seen as an event. I mean, a car accident, a stroke, a health emergency, those typically there's a start point and you know. But mental decline seems to be very, very slow and seems to have moments of lucidity and moments of not.
Well, yeah, and people view that point two ways. Some say, well, yeah, that's true. It is a gray area, and you could very well have two doctors, one agree and one disagree. And some from that derive satisfaction. They may say, if it pertains to them, they may say, well, yeah, I don't want this power to go into effect if there's any doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But the doubt, some argue the opposite. If there's doubt, maybe you do want it to go into mm-hmm. effect. In other words, if it's a gray area, I would rather err on the side of it going into effect than not going into effect. Often doctors can be very self-protective, and maybe they'll err on the side of caution by saying, I'm not going to declare this person incompetent unless I'm persuaded this is the case. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you don't want a bar that high. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want a lower bar, because you can become incompetent, as you say, by degrees. Mm-hmm. And a lot of harm can be done. As you're making this decision now, you're imagining, no, I'll always I'll make good decisions as long as I'm at all competent. But by definition, being quasi-incompetent means you're quasi-subject to bad decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll to give you a personal example. I know someone who began to experience some difficulty and often would lose their keys. They were still driving and they didn't have anyone who had had that in place. And it was 0 degree weather and she had locked herself out of her home. And she was outside trying to figure out what to do when a neighbor found her outside trying to figure out how to get in her house. And I thought, somebody somewhere needs to take control of this.
Now, I'm afraid there's somebody out there right now who's perfectly capable, who's 60 years old, and say, you know, I did that last week.
Well, I might have done that, too. I will confess, yeah.
But your point's well taken. You need somebody to intervene.
This had been an ongoing problem.
Right. It's degenerative. And there's a point when, and all too often, incidentally, this point when people act is too late.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue that the thing you need to fear, and this is based on my experience over many clients, the thing that you need to fear is not that someone will act too soon about your alleged incompetency. The thing you need to fear is that they're going to act too late.
Mm-hmm.
People don't tend to rush in too early.
Right.
It's from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So as to how you handle this power, let me, though, I was going to append to the earlier comment I was making about fortifying. Let's assume that your device goes into effect immediately, or it doesn't. My point will apply to either case. I'm suggesting that you have a provision included in your document where you give someone, perhaps if it's not a trust protector, then you give someone you identify in your family, perhaps a lawyer, if not within the family, another person. This person is to receive periodic documents and reports. That's one thing to include. An alternative or an additional thing to include is that they will have ongoing access by way of the websites, et cetera, ongoing access to balances in all the accounts.
Sounds wonderful.
So what's wonderful about this provision, and you rarely see this, I'm willing to bet that those of you listening, go pull out your power of attorney. I'm willing to bet you don't have a provision like that in there. And it makes so much sense that as long as you have somebody who you know and trust, but maybe you wouldn't ask them to come in and be the person that runs your life. And that's often the problem is there are people we know and trust, but we know that they don't have the time or the inclination perhaps to come in and run your life in this situation. But they are willing to be identified as the person that has access to periodically view these things to assure that things are going as they should. And as long as you have those eyes over the shoulder of someone who's been entrusted, in other words, no longer like these celebrity examples and examples all of us know where essentially the loved one's isolated and you have this person who's just running amok in terms of their assets and using their money and the way they spend it, putting gas in their own cars and giving money to their kids. I mean, all these things that are happening because the victim is isolated and they don't have credibility even if they have suspicions. So they're very, very vulnerable by definition when this power of attorney is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when you most need someone looking over the shoulder of this person, even a loved one, I argue, perhaps most importantly, a loved one.
That's a great idea. I mean, that's one of the things that if you do, again, a quick internet search or you're looking for things, oversight, powers of attorney still need to have a little bit of oversight somewhere.
They do. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll continue this discussion. Back in a moment, Elder Talk.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back with Elder Talk, and we're talking about ways to assure that you're adequately protected in the event that there's a period of time before you leave this world when you're not competent. And we've been talking primarily about durable powers of attorney, though I should mention that a lot can be said for doing this in the form of a trust. The nice thing about the trust is that you have all of the assets titled in the name of the trust, almost all the assets. Sometimes you may have assets that for various reasons that you keep sitting outside the trust, but you make the trust the beneficiary for when you pass away. But it would mean that at any given time while you're alive, that as to those assets, for example, tax-deferred assets, 401ks, typically you will not move those into a trust because it would trigger tax consequences. So often for purposes of estate planning, what you'll do is you'll change the beneficiary to those, and you'll have those to be added to your trust. The moment you die, it belongs to the trust.
Okay.
But what about while you're alive? And in that case, you would have a trustee who would be charged with the contents of the trust. You would have a power of attorney for assets sitting outside the trust. I should also mention that it could be the same person.
Okay.
So there's nothing wrong with having the same person act as a trustee and as a durable power of attorney. And some may be saying, well, why do I want to bother with the trust if I can have this power of attorney?
That's what I was just going to ask. And do I really need both?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a nice, neat package with a bow on it, so to speak. Whenever you can put all your assets, and for those to whom this would be applicable, go ahead and now put all your assets inside a trust and place at the top of that trust the trustee, and have a trigger. It can be a trigger like we talked about, some event, so that it's a springing transition of trustee. It could be that they're a trustee all along, and you make it revocable except when you become incompetent. And then you don't have to necessarily think about the issue of incompetency being an issue, because it doesn't matter unless someone's challenging even the existence of the trust authority. But it's clear that the trustee has power from day one. So even though it only becomes revocable when you become incompetent, the important thing is that the moment you create it, you're putting someone in charge as the trustee. And as to all of the assets that are in it, remember, normally you can change it. You can do anything you want with it. You can pull the assets out. You can spend them, whatever you want. This is a revocable trust we're talking about here, you know, with an exclamation mark. So this trustee, though, if you think about it, has this very orderly list of items over which he or she presides, over which the trust has control. And it's a much more orderly way for you to have your affairs in the event that you become incompetent. You have everything in place immediately, and it's all properly titled as to give a person in a single position authority. It's a little messy if you say power of attorney. Messy may be a harsh word. It's less structured.
Okay.
If you have just the durable power of attorney, you have no trust. And instead, imagine things floating around in space. So you have these intergalactic objects floating around. And these objects may be a vacation home in Florida. It may be a timeshare somewhere. It may be stocks that you own that you invested in your brother-in-law's startup in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
All these things that are the assets, and yes, do they bear your name as an owner? Yes, they do. But beyond that, there's nothing in common among these things floating around in space. So imagine suddenly you have this stroke we've talked about. You end up in a hospital. Suddenly this person gets a phone call, says now you need to take control. You need to commandeer or whatnot all these assets and assume your responsibilities as the holder of this power, this durable power of attorney. So imagine yourself, you get this phone call, it's 10 o'clock at night. Now tell me what you think your next step would be.
Go to bed and not sleep. Well, because I'd be worried, going, what do I have to do next?
Go to bed and stare at the ceiling.
It's exactly right.
Because you're thinking, well,
Where do I start? Really my first question. I don't even know where I would begin unless you're an excellent note taker and you have relayed all that information to me. I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah, and you raise a good point. I mean, there's nothing to forbid you if you decide to have your affairs set up this way with the power of attorney. And remember, whatever flaws are in the scenario I just described, still, it's far better than not having a power of attorney. Let me make that clear. But I'll hurry to add that some people would, in fact, go ahead and provide you know, periodically some updates. These are my assets. But do most people do that? No, they don't. They don't do that because their life changes. They sell stocks. They buy stocks. They sell cars. They buy cars.
They're busy living life.
Yeah.
No one wants to sit down and deal with paperwork.
Yeah. But now many people will be conscientious enough that when they buy an asset to put it in their trust. In other words, if they listen to their lawyer, they'll get into a habit. If they've had a good lawyer to prepare the trust for them, the lawyer said, look, this is the way you do it. And if you don't want to do it, my assistant can do it. It costs you very little. And just send us the information when you acquire a new real estate or whatever it might be. We'll take care of getting it in the trust. But many people, the average person, can handle it themselves. But I think about those two scenarios, and it seems to me that all other things being equal, would I rather have the person that is going to be managing my life in that scenario having everything within a trust and orderly identified, et cetera, and also a fiduciary role. Now, it's true that the person who holds the power of attorney is also a fiduciary, very, very solemn position in the law. Mm-hmm. I can't emphasize to you enough the consequences of breaching it. But I will tell you that the history of duties for trustees is far more abundant and far more ominous to somebody who occupies that role. I can tell you every state in the United States has many cases in which courts have made very, very clear what they do when someone has been negligent, even, not mm-hmm. to mention guilty of misdeeds, what the consequences are if they sit in the position of a trustee. So it is a very, very a well-settled position of immense responsibility. Now, technically, if you go to law school and you have an exam and it says is the holder of a durable power of attorney a fiduciary, the answer to that question is yes.
Yes.
But I'm just telling you, it doesn't come as high-born as the concept, that very lofty, weighty concept of a trustee. So I like that. As a lawyer, I like that. So what we're presenting to those of you listening are a couple ways to do this. And if it gets too complicated and I fear that you're starting to lose enough interest where you're going to just throw up your hands and do nothing, then forget the trust. just say, okay, I'm going to get this piece of paper, maybe 2 pages, 3 pages at most, this power of attorney. I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. And to which I would say magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just suggesting that those of you who are a little more perfectionistic or a little more committed to this question, I'm suggesting that you think about coupling it with a trust in which these two things work in tandem.
Is there a threshold on when a power of attorney went in terms of your asset amount? Is there a threshold where a power of attorney really is enough, or should pretty much everyone have a trust?
I'm a believer that almost everyone should have a trust. And there are lawyers who will argue, no, you know, most people, if you have less than $500,000, forget about it. It doesn't matter. I would argue that it depends on what you mean by that. For full disclosure, I will concede that there is this avenue by which you can accomplish a lot without spending much money, and arguably without spending any money. And by that I mean some lawyers, not many, but there are lawyers who will tell their clients, look, there's probably a device for any particular type asset you have by which you can convey that when you're gone. Now, keep in mind, this has no benefit while you're alive.
Right.
No benefit while you're alive. And I'm answering your question as if it applies not just to lifetime benefits, but benefits thereafter to you in terms of estate planning. They would say, well, look, let's go down the list of your assets. So you have a piece of real estate. Okay, you can do a beneficiary deed. And a beneficiary deed says that when you die, this belongs to so-and-so. Okay, so that particular piece of real estate you've transferred to somebody. What other pieces of real estate do you have? Well, I have this and I have this. So maybe you have two more pieces of real estate. So you do the same thing. You say, okay, I'm going to give this to my daughter, Susan. So let's create a beneficiary deed, file it with the courthouse, and that's done. So the moment you die, it belongs to Susan. She doesn't have an interest while you're alive, so you can still buy and sell. You know, you can do what you want with the property while you're alive. You've not conveyed it, but it takes effect immediately at your death. So what else do you have? Well, I have some brokerage accounts. Okay, let's contact the brokerage account. We'll create a beneficiary clause, a transfer on death provision, And this transfer on death provision will identify who's to get it the moment you die. So you go through your stocks, and now this can get complicated because if you have anything other than an intention to dump it in one or two people's hands, then as you might imagine, this what's envisioned for a few lines as a beneficiary provision can end up being a will. Mm-hmm. Generally, we're envisioning something very, very simple in terms of your plan. What other assets do you have? Well, I have bank accounts. Okay, yeah, we can do PODs on that. So let's go and we'll contact your bank, and as to each one of your accounts, we'll identify somebody that's to get it the moment you die. The bottom line is that you can work through most of your major assets in that fashion. In life insurance, of course, you have a beneficiary provision. Tax-deferred accounts, 401k, IRAs, et cetera, same thing. You have a beneficiary provision. So my point is, can you transfer all your stuff when you die without a will, even without a trust? And for people who are determined to do that, it's like living in Europe on $5 a day. Can you do it? Well, I don't think you do it on $5 a day anymore, but I'm old enough to remember those books. Can you live in Europe or travel Europe for 30 days on $30 a day or 40, whatever the number was? Yeah, it's possible. But my question as to that and as to this is, why would you want to when you have reasonable alternatives? If you don't have reasonable alternatives, you go to Europe for $25. You stay in hostels.
Right.
You know, you sleep on the floor of 30 other people. And same thing here. If you can't do anything else, then yeah, then do that. But for people who can do other things, why wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. And you can accomplish so much more so effectively with a trust. And so I would say, in answer your question a few moments ago, should everyone have a trust? I would say everyone that can possibly afford it should have a trust, and that includes the vast majority of people.
Well, and it seems to me that we have to be careful that, just as we've talked about, we want to have someone who can help us while we're still alive. This
Good
is
point.
Not just for when we're no longer
You're
here.
Right. I didn't answer that question, did I?
Yeah. So that seems to be the biggest reason we need to have these things, is that if I become incompetent or if I become unable and someone needs to sell my house to pay for me to live, then that needs to take place.
Yeah. Yeah. And that we assumed for this show, we assumed that your first order of business is and should be to manage the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing your kids a favor for you to blow this off.
It's living life to your fullest.
These
are the golden years, right?
It's both that, and it's both fulfilling a stewardship responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So not often do those things, you know, go hand in hand, but in this case they do. You're living life the fullest and being a good steward. So I want to, how much time do we have left?
2 minutes.
Oh, geez. Anyway, so let me wrap up here with a couple of quick thoughts about the power of attorney. We advise you to have a protector or someone indicated in your document that has the power to overlook, meaning to look over things that are happening with your account periodically. They can do it as they choose. You can go ahead and have a provision that they're to be submitted to them, a report by whoever is your agent, the holder of the power. You can also have, as a fix for this concern, the appointment of more than one, as we talked about at the beginning of the show, that has that side benefit. While there are potentials for conflict, another good thing is you're very likely to have them to act together conspiratorially if you have two or three named.
Mm-hmm.
So there are pros and cons to that, but it's something you should think about. Another thing is I suggest that you go ahead and have it in effect immediately rather than springing. I think that's an advantage. Let me mention one other thing that's not commonly mentioned. If there's a particular financial institution or a bank with which you've done business historically and you fully intend to as long as you're on this planet, then I would suggest that you might contact them and ask them about what are the characteristics or the qualities of the forms that they are most accepting of. The reason I bring this up is it's not that the document that you go ahead and compile according to the statute is going to be rejected by them. It won't be rejected,
mm-hmm.
I mean, by law. But they can create a few hurdles, and they can require that it have certain characteristics, which, of course, can be easily done. It's not going to kill your deal, but it's delay. So I'm suggesting to you that if you know, and if you don't, that's okay. But if there is a particular bank that has dominated your life and dominated your finances, or there's a particular brokerage firm that has been similarly important in your financial life, then there's certainly nothing wrong with finding out in advance the way they're going to view this document that you're considering. And it may turn out that this triggering thing is a non-event for them, that if you had something that springs into effect, it's a non-event. So just throwing that in there, not many lawyers would suggest this to you, but there's certainly nothing wrong with doing that in advance or even with respect to the document you have. Are we out of time now?
We are out of time.
All right. I hope this has been helpful. Until next time, another episode of Elder Talk. Take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.